once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Doggone, we got it right.
Yeah.
I always feel like that we've accomplished the majority of our objectives for the next 2 hours.
Well, it's the only coordinated objective that we have.
We're uncoordinated the rest of the time?
The rest of the time, we are totally uncoordinated. This is why we tell people don't ask us about sports. Anybody that has to practice for 20-some years, 21 years, to say their names in unison and still occasionally get it wrong, you shouldn't ask them sports questions.
Because that's you're talking about teams.
You got to be coordinated to do that stuff. Mm. Yeah.
Well, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and if you haven't figured out yet, then you probably need to have some psychological evaluation, but it's a radio program. But it's not only a radio program. The name of the Personal Wealth Coach is also shared with an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, which is neither approved nor disapproved by the SEC. That just means they regulate them or inspect them or are the regulating authority if you want to make complaints.
And that organization's principles happen to be the same principles of this radio talk show or program.
It's not a show. You have instructed me on many occasions that it is not a show.
It's this peer pressure business.
It's a tell.
Everybody has been telling me my entire life, radio show, not recognizing that there is a problem with that concept in general.
It's actually a tell.
Yes, it is definitely a tell.
Or it could be here as opposed to there.
It's a radio hearing?
A radio here.
Radio there?
It's like a TVC.
It's a broadcast.
Yes, anyway. Let's see, what else we got to say? That we don't give investment advice on this radio program, even though we collectively, the two of us, are the principals at an investment advisory firm. Because investment advice is given to individuals and concerns their specific needs and their goals and their objectives and their situation, et cetera, whereas we do give educational information on this radio program, and the information we give has been obtained from sources we believe to be reliable, but we do not make any warranty or guarantee as to its completeness or accuracy. Boy, is that ever lawyerly. You know, I wonder, does Ed say that on his program?
About what?
He makes no guarantee or warranty as to the completeness or accuracy.
Why would he say that?
I don't know.
That would make it sound like
the lawyers have asked us to say it.
Yeah, the lawyers ask us to say it. They don't have to say it. That's a different thing.
Mm.
Yeah.
We also need to tell you that we advertise on KTEM, and if you listen to KTEM very much, you'll probably hear one of our advertisements. But the advertisements are for this program, which is odd that we have to tell you that we advertise for this program. We do. We pay them to advertise, but they don't pay us to be on the program. We don't pay them for this 2 hours that we do. They ask us to do it because they had 2 hours and thought we might get some good ratings, and occasionally we hear that maybe we do get good ratings, and then they advertise on our program. That was very laborious, but that's the way it is. Is there anything else we need to say? Close cover before striking, except that really doesn't count anymore because people don't have covers to close. When's the last time you saw a matchbook?
Wait, here we go. Contents may be hot. That covers a whole spectrum of things, so
I got to think about that a little bit. Contents may be hot.
Right.
But they taste better that way. Anyway.
Well, it depends on the contents. If the contents of this episode, it may not taste very good.
That's true.
As hot as it gets.
That's true. We should warn people that listening to two guys talk about economics for 2 hours could cause narcolepsy onset. If you're driving, this may be hazardous to your health.
You may need to pull over if you're listening to this program as threat of somnolence may occur.
Yeah, okay. Well, this week there were a lot of headlines about markets.
Yes, there were. I noticed that.
But not very much happened.
Well, some important things happened, just the market didn't move tremendously during the process.
Well, it finally lost about 1.5% for the S&P 500 lost about 1.5% for the week, which isn't much in the big scheme of things, considering how much it went up and down during the week and how much the headlines indicated things were coming apart at the seams. And we have a caller on 773-1400. That's, by the way, our telephone number is 254-773-1400. If today is August 17th, 2019, where you are, you're certainly welcome to give us a call. And we have a caller on that number. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Well, I got to turn up their volume first.
I was going to ask you this question concerning currency. You know, the Susan B. Anthony dollar came around, and you don't hardly ever see that Susan B. Anthony. Of course, the $2 bill, you can purchase that at the bank by request. You know, just different currencies. Like back in the day, they had gold pieces, you know, they would have deals with. But as far as time goes on, why is it that these legal tender coins or currencies just kind of fading away on the wayside, and you don't really see them that much anymore like you used to back in the day? You have a good day.
All right. Well, I can answer that one. The Susan B. Anthony dollar coin was approximately the same size as a quarter.
And it's confusing in people's pockets.
After spending a few dollars thinking you were spending 25-cent quarters, that got very unpopular. The other thing is carrying a small piece of paper around and carrying a heavy coin around, yes. Most people would prefer the small piece of paper.
You know, it's kind of interesting because in Europe, it's really normal to use coins for your 1 or 2 euro denominated, all the way up through, you know, you use a pocket full of change. And in the United States, people really don't like pockets full of change.
Mm-hmm.
Borrowing political slogans like hope and change, what we're really talking about is hope and paper.
The $2 coin in Canada is quite popular, but it's larger than the equivalent of a 25-cent coin. And it's got a loon on it, and it's called a loonie.
It's a loonie.
And it's an extremely popular in vending machines. Extremely popular. Vending machines take it. And it is widely accepted. It just never the issue is when the committee, I guess it's Congress was the committee.
No, it's a Treasury Department committee that chooses the size and the shape of all the currencies.
They just managed to make a dollar coin that looked like a quarter and was the size of a quarter and weighed about as much as a quarter. And it just never went over very well. I remember when it came out and we were force issuing them. In the Army, I was occasionally rotated around on the roster as a paymaster, and we were force issuing $2 coins in mass quantities of $2 coins, and the soldiers didn't like them at the time, and we didn't like them because I got them mixed up with quarters on several occasions, and finally the thing just died away, and it died properly.
You can still go and get a Susan B. Anthony coin, and people still take them. It's still legal tender, And just as a side note, we have another caller waiting, but let me throw this in here. The word currency really does come from the flow of liquid, like a current in the ocean or a river. So a currency is a flow of exchange, basically. And we tend to call the dollar the currency, even though there's all kinds of denominations of dollars, when numbers of how many are there, and thank you. I just had a big ball of fuzz attached to my headset.
It was driving me crazy.
I should have left it there and just looked confused.
Yes.
Anyway, currency, the currency is the dollar, and however, whatever form that comes in, whether it's just a handful of pennies or a Susan B. Anthony or a $2 bill, the dollar itself is a really viable currency. It's in a lot more circulation across the planet than any other currency. And that's interesting to note that we're going the paper route where most of the rest of the world is going the coin route for the lower denominations. And for some reason...
And both are quickly being replaced by electronics.
Yes. And we do have a caller on 773-1400. So caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hello. Hello. Caller, you're breaking up really, really badly. You may need to call back.
Yep. Anyway, the markets. did a lot of seesawing around, and they made the headlines, and made a lot of the seesawing around that the stock market did this week was because of the headlines, and a lot of the headlines were because of the stock market. So we have a classic feedback loop that was going on. The market dropped about 3% on Wednesday, and that made headlines everywhere. And probably, it's anybody's guess as to why it dropped. It's always anybody's guess. But probably had something to do with the fact that the major news media discovered that the yield curve had gotten severely inverted after the president's announcement about tariffs again.
Right.
And we have another caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
You don't have another caller. You got the same one.
All right. Well, welcome back then.
Do y'all mind me asking you a couple questions on your newsletter?
Sure. Go ahead.
A couple of statements y'all made in the first part of the newsletter. It says over the last 2 weeks, despite all the headlines, the SPX only lost about 1.5 and down, 4.6
right.
from all-time high. It says the last statement says very notably though it is current level. The stock market is a bit lower than it was last September. And about where we were in January of
2018.
That yeah. I have made zero money, more or less, since for this year.
Well, if you're invested in an S&P 500 index fund with very low expenses,
that would be where
you're pretty close.
Yeah.
And so I can't actually say that, I guess, can I? I'd have to look at each individual portfolio.
You just have to look at your total balance and see how well you've done. There have been elements in the market that have gone up. There have been elements in the market that have gone down. The important thing, the reason that we mentioned that in the newsletter is because if somebody looks at where they were from a year ago and they note the headlines that the market is up, and I don't ever report on that, but the market is up a bunch from the beginning of the year. Well, it was down a bunch at the end of last year. And so, in essence, what we've seen over the last 18 months, since the trade war started, is a rather high variance or volatility in the market. But despite all the upside and downside, it really hadn't gone anywhere. Now, the economy has continued to grow. Oddly enough, and this is the struggle that the market is having, we're in an earnings recession. Earnings are across the board in the S&P 500 stock index, corporate earnings are flat to down. And at the beginning of the year, there was an assumption widespread. I mentioned this in the newsletter that the earnings would rise about 10% this year, and they had the potential to do so. And now the consensus of analysts is they may rise 1 or 1.5%. And the reason it really boils down to one issue. There's a lot of other things going on in the world, but the trade war is the issue. We launched a trade war with China.
And with the rest of the world.
And it is kind of a simmering, almost trade war with Europe. And we launched a trade war with Canada and Mexico, our two biggest trading partners. And it is impacting corporate earnings a lot. The underlying economy, the spending by consumers is still up. And so the market can't figure out whether to be depressed or elated. The collective wisdom, and as a result, it has gone from we've gone bipolar for a while.
And well, that's kind of in your last paragraph, and that's what I really kind of called about. It was this last paragraph you said that you're expecting in the next 12 to 18 months a recession, possibly, and you said that it's. It looks like, as you said, the good news is that it's leading up to a classic recovery. Exactly what would y'all do? What do y'all do to kind of make that recession easier for people?
Okay. Well, you talk about it or you want to?
Well, I can begin. First thing we do is we recognize that recessions happen.
All the time.
Yeah.
Well, not all the time. It's been 10 years.
they average over the last century. Has been every 4 years we have a recession. What are recessions good for? I know it sounds like a song.
war. Well, what's it good for?
I think I've been in recession all my life. So.
well, we
that's a joke. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. We know right now we're at full employment or very, very close. And one of the things that is a lagging indicator is employment. So when things have been going well for a long time, a lot of people have been hired. When things start going badly, it takes a while before people start being laid off. But when you have, we're at absolute record levels. We have never had this percentage of the population employed in the United States before. We're at absolutely record levels of employment in the United States.
Never?
Never.
Well, let me explain. There's an exception to that. During the Vietnam War, for a short period of time.
I can say not even then.
It got below 3.7?
Oh,
it got below 3.7.
No, I'm not talking about an unemployment rate here. I'm saying the as a percentage of the population.
Ah, the percentage of the total population.
Because in the Vietnam War, only about 20% of women were working.
Ah, I got you.
So where we are today, we have no comparison in the past. There are more people in, as a percentage of our population, working than have ever been working before. And that means that we've employed a lot of people that at other times in our lifetimes, at other times not that long ago, we would have said, we won't hire that person. But we need as many people as we can, so we're working extra hard to train the people that maybe weren't qualified. And there's a lot of that going on. And you also have people that are just tired and burned out. So we're seeing our productivity numbers drop. As productivity drops, you would think, well, you just get rid of your unproductive employees. Well, you can't, because if demand is up, you got to keep doing that. It takes a recession where earnings drop for us to enforce work ethics. That's one piece. It's also at the executive level, you get a bloat that starts to occur after a great deal of long-term earnings success. More and more of the earnings get devoted to executive compensation.
Wait. You're saying that it takes a recession to get rid of the deadwood, the people that are not working?
You got it.
That's correct. And unfortunately, I wish that people would be able to keep to that ethic
all the
time.
Not only does it get rid of people who are not working, it gets rid of zombie companies. And there are a significant number of zombie corporations and companies out there that keep borrowing more and more money to stay viable. For example, Uber has never made a profit, and it probably never will make a profit. And it's going to take a recession for them to finally recognize they're dead.
Either that or they're going to change their entire business model. And that's what many people are betting on, that they'll change their business model. But the reality is that a lot of people that are investing in Uber are doing it because it's a headline company. They don't have any idea about anything about it, except sometimes they like to use Uber. They don't know what profitability it has. They've just put some money on there hoping that the market's going to go crazy on it.
And we'll lose some banks.
Yeah.
Because we need to lose some banks. Basically, It's the forest is growing, and there's a bunch of diseased, nearly dead trees being held up by the rest of the forest. And it's not until a storm comes along that the diseased and dead trees actually fall over.
And you're talking about companies.
Right.
Companies,
correct.
And people.
Or trees. That as well.
So, or fish.
Yeah, or fish. Or so the idea
deer.
Here is, number one, let's say some things right at the beginning of this. Well, at the middle part of this. It's been 10 years since the last recession, and normally what I would say is the longer you go between recessions, the more of the dead wood that builds up, and so it might be a really bad recession, except this 10 years, we haven't had crazy growth. This hasn't been like the 1990s or the 1980s. We've had moderate growth, very slow economic growth, very slow hiring process. If you look at the unemployment graph and you go, if you do things like in a nerdly way, like the two bald guys behind the microphones here, if you go to the Labor Department's website and you look at the graph for unemployment, you can see this very, very smooth drop from the high in 2009.
this very smooth, gradual drop with no real spikes or changes all the way to today. So you could blame this on, or you could say the unemployment is the fault of any of the three presidents that were there, except that at each transition point from George W. Bush to Barack Obama to Donald Trump, there's no change in the slope. It hasn't. There's no policy that's jumped in there and said we're going to hire more people because of one president or another. And that's something we've said for many years, is that the presidents aren't the people hiring. They get the credit or the blame for the unemployment, but they're not the one. Well,
in the 1960s, they were the people hiring.
That's true. The draft was a real thing at the time. So
I mean, the president of the United States is the one who invited me to join the Army.
So the deadwood has been acquired in this lack of recession period very slowly. But it's there. And we're due for one at some point. We need to clear out the deadwood. Our productivity numbers need to come back up. And that means we need to get rid of some people that aren't being very productive. You've got more?
Go ahead. I just want to cut to the chase here. And then we can come back. We need recessions. But generally speaking, expansions following a really, really bad recession, we had the Great Recession.
It wasn't very great, if you ask me.
They tend to be much longer than the, because the further down you go, the longer you can go up on the other side. It really boils down to. But you ask a question about how do we prepare for that.
Can I go listen to you on the radio?
Sure.
It's a good idea.
I sure appreciate y'all's program. Thanks.
All right, thanks
for the call.
In a nutshell, we do not try to time the market. Why do we not try to time the market? Well, with 2020 hindsight, we can see all the symbols and everything, and we should know exactly when to get out and exactly when to get in, except that nobody, and I mean this with underlined three times, nobody has been able to consistently jump in and out of the market at the right time historically. The worst collectively, the worst returns of a set of investors have come out of market timers.
Yeah.
They've actually managed to have negative returns during bull markets, which is pretty hard to do, but they've managed to do it. And I've watched timers do it. So what we say is, in a nutshell, we hold a degree of dry powder, and it varies with each client. And we have it in short-term bonds and cash. And if a person is taking systematic withdrawals in retirement, we have a pretty solid minimum of 18 months, and we prefer more, of withdrawals and expenses programmed into the portfolio, because, and then we have a second layer of securities that we think that typically come back very quickly after a recession. So the bottom line to it is, ride it out if you are accumulating, and have reserves if you're decumulating, if you're taking money out. And we have another caller on 773-1400, don't we?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Caller on 773-1400, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I have a quick question. Well, I've got two, actually. What is the difference between investing in a gold mine or buying gold versus a group that calls themselves the International Gold Mine Consortium, or the International Gold? And the second question is, the oil industry is really taking a beating right now. Is that a temporary thing, in your opinion, or is it going to improve? I'm looking at stocks like Chevron and Mobil Chemical and Exxon, and I guess that's my question. Appreciate it, guys.
Man, if we could answer that second question, you couldn't afford to ask us. But I can answer the first one.
Go ahead.
I'd like to.
And I may touch on it as well.
Okay. When you invest in somebody who theoretically holds gold for you, gold, you don't know if they really got the gold or if they've sold the same bar to five people.
Yeah. So they need to be audited by a third party. And most of the consortium and gold holding companies are not audited by third parties.
And you're buying a non-productive asset. Now, if you buy a gold mine share in a gold mining company, Barrick or whatever, one of the gold miner companies, you're buying a security that's registered with the SEC that is annually audited by one of the big auditing companies. You're buying a security, and you're looking at profits and losses. Now,
right,
the price of gold is going to affect that stock over the short term. Over the long term, it's like anything else. The price of cars is going to affect the shares of General Motors.
But if the effort is, let me give you an example here of you're trying to make a profit on a gold mine. If you're trying to make
it's owned by a corporation.
Right. The corporation here is trying to make a profit. So they're going to be hopefully more nimble when the price of gold drops on what they're mining and what they're not mining than somebody that only has one mine.
And we firmly believe, and it is borne out through history, that increase in value comes with increase in utility.
Right.
Now, temporary speculative surges in value can occur with no increase in utility. But what corporations are supposed to do is they're supposed to convert something that's not worth very much into something that is worth more and then sell it. And if they do a good job of that, then they should be recognized at some point to say, oh, they're going to continue to do this, and they're doing a better job of it every year. Therefore, they're going to be worth more money in the future.
And the profit comes from that actual conversion process, that you take something that is easy to get and you convert it into something that is not easy to get somehow, and you get paid for doing it. That's utility.
Which is, incidentally, exactly what oil companies do.
Right.
It's interesting that you're interested in the oil and gold, because they're both mining.
Yeah.
And they both do, in essence, the same thing. They get stuff out of the ground and convert it into something useful.
A company that just holds oil and distributes it, if they've got a lot of tanks, big tanks, then they should be paid a profitable amount of money. But if the demand for oil drops, sometimes they've just got to hold that, and it's kind of like a rental agreement where there's nobody paying the lease. So it's true kind of across the board. Why should someone make a profit? If you buy gold or oil in its raw form, so you get a barrel full of oil. There's 42 gallons in that barrel, just as a side note, and I think the number is appropriate.
Yes.
The 42 gallons of oil sitting in a barrel in your driveway. That barrel is going to fluctuate in value just based on how much oil is out there and how much people want the oil. What can you do to that oil to make it more profitable to sell regardless of the oil price? Well, you can refine it. You can make it into plastic. You can make it into gasoline, into kerosene, into all kinds of different poly products that you can then turn around and make into something else that people are willing to pay a lot more than the raw oil for. In the end, when you're talking about a polyester shirt, the price of oil has an impact on that shirt, but you're talking about pennies on something that may be worth $20 or $30. You're talking about pennies being the cost involved. So if you've just got oil or just got gold, what's the difference between that, just holding that and hoping someone will pay you more for it, or going into business to convert that into something that people want to buy for its own sake rather than for the raw potential that lies there? And that's the first question you asked, is what's the difference between owning gold and owning a company that mines for gold? That's it, is that the company mining for gold is taking dirt and rock and turning it into a base element. And that takes some skill, some know-how, some research, and some equipment. You throw that all together, and you've got a reason why someone should make a profit if they do it reasonably well.
The other thing to remember is the difference between buying corporations and buying commodities. Commodities deteriorate in value over time. That is a rule. That is, over a long period of time, commodities are deteriorating in value. Even people say, well, gold doesn't. Well, yeah, it does.
If you
don't hold it in your hand, if you hold it in your hand, you've got a price to have it reassayed when you go to sell it.
Unless it's a coin that's regulated by Treasury Department or something.
But if you look at the long-term history, that's the way it works. I mean, if you bought gold in 1980 or 82 and you sold it today and you factor in inflation, you lost money. The reality of it is that if you hold gold that's being held in a vault someplace, they're charging you rent to hold that gold. If you hold oil and you put it in the hypothetical barrel in your driveway, The barrel is causing the gold. If you own oil and you put it in the hypothetical barrel, the barrel is gradually deteriorating, and the oil itself inside the barrel, as it reacts with the barrel or in the tank,
it's becoming cruder.
It's deteriorating. I mean, that's just the reality of commodity. Any commodity that you purchase, if you have to do it, that's why.
And then you've got
commodities. Speculators do it quickly. They buy and sell them quickly.
There's another cost to this transaction, and it's a pretty important one. If you have a spouse, you've got a barrel of oil in your driveway.
Mm-hmm.
Think of the emotional cost with a spouse involved. Why do you have a barrel of oil in the driveway? And
so
you can fill in any place you want to put that. You can put it in your garage. You can put it in the living room. Mm-hmm. There's different costs associated with the different location. And sometimes it's monetary, and sometimes it's more valuable than money.
And then there's the catastrophic risk. That commodities all carry catastrophic risk, which you think, why catastrophic risk?
Yes.
If that barrel of oil starts to leak, it went from being a potentially profitable investment to a guaranteed huge loss because you just violated all the environmental
right, and you got to clean that up, especially if it's in the living room.
Yes.
Because the environmental problem in the living room is less important than the spousal problem in the living room.
A breakthrough in gold ore refining, the ability to bring an asteroid back full of gold is a catastrophic. That would be a catastrophic loss for the price of gold.
And I'm going to do kind of a crazy about face and take us deep into history for a moment.
Oh, by the way, another thing about gold. A sudden rise in the value of the dollar will depreciate your gold in a hurry.
Yes. The source and meaning of the word confusion as we know it stems from gold. And stems specifically from the Great Fire of London of 1666. Because these banking organizations were not banking organizations at the time. The currency, the pound, and we've got a caller waiting. Just hold on for a minute. We'll be right with you. The currency, the pound in England, was kind of the laughing stock of the world. It wasn't for another decade and a half that Isaac Newton steps in as in charge of the currency and actually created the pound as we know it.
They were using actually crowns at the time.
So the pound based on silver is very different from the crown of before that. So you have most people in England owned their assets, their liquid assets, their money was not really money. It was in candlesticks and forks and knives. So you had gold candlesticks and silver forks and knives. And they would put those on deposit at the original form of bank. A bank is a buried thing. You can bank a coal. There's banks of a river. That's where the dirt builds up. So these original banks really were banks. They were built into the side of the river because there was easy to dig in areas and they could make a vault down there. Well, then you brought your candlestick to them. You tie a ribbon around it, write your name on there. There's my candlestick. You've got that right there. They may write down that you had a candlestick and it's got a blue ribbon on it. Okay, now they can find it in all the other candlesticks. Till the fire hit. The word fuse is when you take the same type of metal and heat it up and put two pieces of it together. It fuses. It's very nice. Confusing is when you take two different kinds of metal and you heat them up and you push them together. The reason why we use confused the way we use it today is because the Great Confusion, just like we call something the Great Recession today, they had the Great Confusion after the fire. Only the people that kept copious paper records and were able to take them away were able to say at the end of the fire when they got into the vault and they noticed that everything was puddled together on the floor, they had to separate that out by weight.
And it was by the pound.
By purity, by the pound. If they didn't keep good records, the confusion was very real. Nobody knew who owned that lump of metal. Very much like the collateralized mortgage obligations of 2008. So we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. There was an article Monday in the Wall Street Journal, Investors Weigh Specter of Sub-Zero Rates. I guess some of this is going on in European countries. What do you guys think of the chances of that coming to the U.S.? And what's, if it does, what's going to be the effect on money market accounts? Is that going to break the sacred dollar standard? Thank you.
Okay. Appreciate that. That's fantastic. He always asks good questions.
He always asks very thoughtful questions.
This week, Alan Greenspan was asked about that. So should we refer to him?
We can.
He says he wouldn't be surprised if we turn negative at some point. Not necessarily right away, but at some point in the future, because it's no big deal. I'm going to use his quote. Should I say it in his voice as well?
It's up to you.
It's a monotone, very quiet voice. This is international arbitrage going on in the bond market that is helping drive long-term treasury yields lower. There you go.
Yeah.
Now I could apply to be chairman of the Federal Reserve. Basically, what is international arbitrage? Arbitrage is when you can find a better deal somewhere else, so you can take what you have found in one place to another place to make a better profit than selling it near where you found it. That's arbitrage. So if you are on Craigslist and you see a motorcycle and you say it's worth $50 here, but if I buy this motorcycle and I drive an hour and list it again on Craigslist, it's worth $400. There's a $350 profit out of simple arbitrage, just moving from one place to another. The international bond market is full of that. Go ahead.
Negative yields, it's important to recognize what a negative yield is. It's normal. And I'm, wow, people say it's not
normal.
Wait
a minute, this has never happened before. No, it's absolutely normal.
In the first half of the 20th century, banks did not pay interest. You deposited the money, and in some cases, you paid a fee.
Right. It's very much like having a safety deposit box.
Right.
That's the way banks usually ran all the way through history until relatively recently.
So if I give my money, my dollars, to the United States government, and say, and the government promises they will return those dollars after so many years, that has a value. When in a situation where there is economic uncertainty, that's a tremendous value. And today, the people in Germany are quite confident their government will return their money, so they're willing to loan out past 10 years and pay the government for the right to do so. In other words, what the investor who is buying a 10-year Bund from the German government today is saying is, I don't expect inflation is going to be much of anything. We might even get deflation over the next 10 years. Therefore, I am going to be willing to get fewer euros back 10 years from now than I'm giving the German government today. Although if the euro collapses, the German government is, people generally tend to be quite confident that the German government will convert back to marks and they'll get 1 mark per euro. In the United States, the government of the United States is borrowing so much money that we still have to pay interest on it. Although the lower the interest rates get, the less we're having to pay on it, which is a little scary. But the bottom line to it is we are in an environment where negative yields may very well come to the United States, particularly in the next recession.
And something important to note, this is the last part of the question. We have another caller waiting. We'll be right with you. The last part of the question is, will that break the dollar and the money market fund?
No.
What does that mean, folks, to those that don't know what that means? A money market it's typically a open-ended mutual fund, and they have shares. And the idea here is that each share value should be $1, so that you can have a number of units that represents the number of dollars that you have on deposit at this money market. Money markets have different methods of getting their interest rates. They're not a bank. They're an investment vehicle. And I know that's weird because they're pretty much sticking to very cash-like entities. They invest in treasury bonds, treasury bills, treasury notes, mostly notes, mostly very short-term stuff. The other thing that they invest in is bank repo paper. What is that? And I don't, that isn't like repossessed items. It's not like the repo man coming to get a car. A repo rate is, banks are charged a rate by the Federal Reserve. When they don't have enough money on hand, they can go to the Federal Reserve and get a loan to maintain their reserve requirements. That's the rate that gets moved around by the Federal Reserve when they meet. When the board of the Federal Reserve meets, they move that rate up and down. Now, banks charge each other a rate as well. So the Federal Reserve charges one bank a certain amount, and then that bank may turn around and make a loan to another bank on the same day, and they're going to charge a slightly higher interest rate. The difference between those two rates is significant. So that second rate is called the repo rate, where they got the loan from the Federal Reserve and turned around and immediately gave it to another bank. There's only about 0.2% of profit there. But 0.2% in profit is very real, especially when you're talking about a lot of money. So that 0.2%, another very significant piece of that is double what it has been on average for the past 50 years. Repos are supposed to be extremely inexpensive. So there are still ways of making interest by using Federal Reserve very low interest rate money and turning and making a loan to another bank who's also very likely to pay it back on a 30-day note. So there are ways for the money market funds to not break the dollar, to maintain either a positive interest rate or at least not a negative one, or if there's a negative one, to charge units like $1 in fractional shares rather than to say this unit is not worth $1. And that's really what they'll go to. They won't break the dollar. And do you have anything else to add to that before we go to the next caller?
I think government money market funds might shut down if we go to if we became like Germany, where we had a negative return on short-term treasuries.
They've had some money market issues over in Europe.
And the government money market funds might just fold up. But that doesn't mean that corporate, high-grade corporate short-term cash positions would go negative, and they haven't in Europe.
Germany's entire yield curve is below 0%. That's just an interesting little phenomenon. And we have another caller on 254-773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
You guys have a great show. I enjoy it. Excuse me if I haven't heard, if this hasn't been discussed, but in watching TV, I see all these ads for buying gold. I know gold's at a high rate. I hear a lot of talking heads talking about the importance of buying gold. I have never bought it. I would like y'all's opinion on it, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
That's a good point. We did make it a little earlier, but again, gold, if you buy gold, you're gambling, and you're gambling with an asset that over the very long term declines in value. And I know that's not what the advertisements are saying.
But it's very easy to track statistically.
But the SEC does not regulate, nor does much of anybody else regulate gold advertisements, because they're commodities, and commodities are not regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission.
It's like if you want to dig up some dirt and sell dirt online,
yes,
it's a commodity.
You
can say, right, this dirt is cheaper than dirt, and that is an oxymoron in itself, because it would be as cheap as it is, and that would be how cheap dirt is.
Gold has been pretty – if you take long-term averages, gold has been losing money for 600 years. I mean, it's worth less today than it was 600 years ago,
right,
a lot less.
And that's very easy to track in a way that doesn't have to do with money, but we can talk about that at another point.
But the issue is that if you buy gold, remember, you're just rolling the dice, and you're rolling the die. And remember, when you gamble in a casino, the casino always wins. And so when you're gambling with gold, the gold dealer is probably going to win, because he's going to charge you a fee to buy it, and he's going to charge you a fee to sell it. And very frankly, unless you get the gold in your hand, in which case you're a numismatist collecting on the
rarity of a given coin,
the demand for a given coin, unless you're
And that's arbitrage. That's what we were just talking about. If you're good at arbitrage, you could possibly do well doing this.
The key here to remember, not only do commodities such as gold or corn or anything else, the longer you hold them, the more likely you are to take a loss. The fact is they're not producing utility. And because they're not producing utility, there's no economic reason they should go up in value.
That's different.
Price of gold is based on three things. How many people in India are buying and selling it? How many people in Russia are buying and selling it?
China.
And the value of the dollar.
Yeah, China and India are the two by far biggest demand points for gold. And they outnumber our demand on that subject about 28-3.
And if you wanted to buy something to hedge your account. In other words, gold is used as a hedge. If the economy craters, then the price of gold goes up. That's not true. In 2008 through in 2009, when we were having the Great Recession, the price of gold fell. Why? Because people in financial trouble sell their gold. It's that simple. If you wanted to buy a hedge that you could depend on, either put cash in there or buy Treasury securities, because they are one of the reasons interest rates are so low on treasuries is basically as things become critical and crisis looms, people buy U.S. Treasury securities because they are considered to be the most secure, safe investment in the world. And they are undoubtedly, without any question at all, the most secure and safe place to put your money in the world. Gold is not. For more reasons, I mean, we could go on for 2 hours about all the potential pitfalls in buying gold.
And we can, I'll give you some numbers here, but before I say the numbers, I'm going to give you some of the meaning of the numbers.
2, 5, 7, right. And 42.
73, 51.
Okay, hut. Now we've given some numbers.
If you want to look at an investment opportunity, one of the things – we've got some commercials to play. We may need to cover this really thoroughly next hour.
Yeah.
Because there's some really good stuff on what causes a bubble, why is it the demand is what it is, what percentage of the demand is in speculation, and what percentage of the demand is in use. All of those items are important when you're buying something. So we're going to play some commercials. We'll be back. Hopefully we'll have some time to talk about that before the end of the hour. If not, we'll talk about it next hour. We'll be back on the other side. The phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We only got about 4 minutes left in the first hour. Of course, we got a whole second hour coming in. We still haven't discussed some of the fundamental things that are going on in the economy.
Do you mind if I just quick finish this
go
off?
Ahead, finish it off. Pow!
There's a website called gold.org, and you can go there and see some tremendously good statistics on the demand of supply and supply of gold. Jewelry accounts for about 530 tons a year on the demand side. Technology, about 81 tons a year. Now, if you think about that at a global level, only 531 tons, gold is rare. So we've got that out there. If jewelry and technology were the only use for gold, we would expect to see the demand for jewelry and the demand for technology have a really big impact on the price. And what is technology? They put it in electronics. Gold is a noble metal, so it's not losing its electrons as it's moving around.
So how many tons are produced a year?
Here we go on to this one. So what else is it used for? What are the demand? Well, the central banks buy up about 224 tons a year. Investment, that's people that are mostly in India and China, buy 285 tons. So if you combine those two, what you have is near half of the usable gold is purchased just to hold it. It has a much larger impact on the price of gold at the market than the people that are buying it for jewelry or the people that are buying it for technology. If you're just buying raw gold and you're trying to use it for technology, you're at the whim of the collectors of gold that are saying it's an investment. So they're holding it, hoping that other people will want to hold it for more money later. If we're looking at Bitcoin, if we look, there's a good way of looking at what is a bubble. And I'm going to try to say this really fast. Any new thing that's being sold or anything that's important that's being sold, there's a group of people that are actually using it for something, or why would it have even started being around? So people are using it, whether that's Bitcoin and people are using it to do transactions online or whatever. When the majority or near majority of the people that are using that item are not using that item, they're using it to sell it to somebody else later for more. That's the definition of a bubble, which means that gold has been in a bubble for thousands of years. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say something real quickly. If you're seeing a lot of advertisements for people who want to sell gold, they're paying a lot of money to try to unload gold.
Yes.
So does it make any sense to buy when you see the people with a lot of money and a very sophisticated going to sell, and we're out of time for this hour?
Yes. So we have about 30 seconds left. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting. We do give investment advice to individuals in a fiduciary relationship. The phone number there is locally 254-947-1111, or you can go toll-free to 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can contact us there, or you can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. I do encourage people to go to the website. There are newsletters on there. Our radio program going back quite a ways is. Until next hour.